A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about Tashalay, the blue dye from the ancient world that was used on prayer shawls, the Zitzit. It was lost for over 1,300 years, and the source was only properly identified in our lifetimes. He wants to know what makes it chemically unique, why it was so revered in the ancient world, and why it couldn't just be swapped out with any other blue dye. And honestly, this is one of those stories where the science and the history are so tangled up together that you can't really understand one without the other.
The chemistry here is genuinely wild. We're talking about a molecule that is, at the atomic level, almost identical to plant indigo, except for two bromine atoms. That's it. Two bromine atoms are the difference between a dye anyone could make from a plant in their backyard and a dye that required 12,000 sea snails to produce enough for a single garment. 12,000 snails, corn, for one talet.
That's the sort of ratio that makes you wonder who looked at a pile of snails and thought, yes, this is worth the effort. I mean, imagine being the first person to attempt this. You've got a basket of mollusks. They're starting to smell. You've crushed a few and your hands are stained purple. At what point do you decide to scale up to industrial quantities?
Hunger and desperation, probably. But the result was something that the ancient world couldn't replicate any other way. The molecule is called 6,6-dibromyl indigo, or DBI. The chemical formula is C16H8Br2N2O2. Plant indigo is C16H10N2O2. Those two bromine atoms replace two hydrogen atoms, and that tiny substitution changes everything about how the molecule behaves with light.
We're talking about a dye that is chemically almost identical to indigo, but functionally completely different because of two atoms. That's absurd. It's like having two cars that look identical on the assembly line, but one of them has a different bolt in the engine, and suddenly it can fly.
That's actually not a bad analogy. The bromine atoms are heavy. Bromine has an atomic mass of about 80 compared to hydrogen's mass of 1, so you're replacing two featherweight atoms with two heavyweights. That changes the electron distribution across the entire molecule, which changes how it absorbs and reflects light. It's the same principle that makes ruby and sapphire different colors, even though they're both basically aluminum oxide. A tiny impurity transforms the optical properties entirely.
In this case, the impurity is deliberate and essential. So walk me through the actual dyeing process, because you mentioned sunlight being the critical variable.
It gets better. The raw dye extracted from the snails is actually purple. It's the same molecule that produces Tyrian purple, the dye reserved for Roman emperors. But here's the key. If you expose the dye to sunlight during the dyeing process, the ultraviolet light knocks off one of those bromine atoms through photochemical degradation, and the color shifts from purple to a deep sky blue. That blue is Tashalay. Keep it in the dark during processing. You get Tyrian purple. Expose it to sunlight, you get the biblical blue.
The same snail. The same molecule. The same extraction process. And the only variable is whether you let the sun hit it. That's an almost poetic distinction between the royal color and the sacred one. It's as if the dye itself contains a theological statement. The imperial purple is made in darkness, hidden away, while the sacred blue requires light to become what it's meant to be.
It gave the ancient dyers a built-in authenticity test. If someone tried to pass off plant indigo as Tashalay, you could just leave the fabric in the sun. Real Tashalay would shift from purple to blue during the dyeing process and then stay blue. Fake Tashalay made from indigo would just stay blue the whole time. It doesn't have those bromine atoms to react with light. The chemical signature was impossible to forge with the technology of the time.
Of course there are. A built-in counterfeit detection system from 3,000 years ago. That's better than a watermark. You can't bribe the sun.
Think about what that means for the ancient dye worker. You're standing there with your vat, and you can actually watch the color change happen in real time as the sunlight hits it. It would look like magic, the purple liquor slowly shifting to blue before your eyes. No wonder they thought this stuff was connected to the divine.
Let's get into the snail itself, because I think most people imagine something like a garden snail, and that's not what we're dealing with.
The snail itself is called Murex trunculus, though taxonomists have reclassified it as Hexaplex trunculus because nothing in biology is allowed to keep its name. It's a predatory sea snail that lives along the Mediterranean coast. It's not a cute little garden snail. It's a spiky, aggressive carnivore that drills into other mollusks and eats them. Each snail has a hypobranchial gland that produces a tiny amount of clear mucus. When that mucus is exposed to air and sunlight, it turns first yellow, then green, then blue, then purple. The amount per snail is absurdly small, 1 to 2 milligrams of raw dye. To get enough for a single tallet, you'd need roughly 12,000 snails.
12,000 snails for one garment. That's not a dye industry. That's a monument to persistence. And it also means that if you're a dye worker in ancient Phoenicia, you're not just dealing with one vat. You're processing snails by the thousands every single day. The smell alone must have been apocalyptic.
The ancient dye factories were always located downwind of cities for exactly that reason. The Roman writer Vitruvius complained about the stench. You're dealing with rotting mollusk flesh on an industrial scale. The workers who did this were not living glamorous lives, even if their product ended up on the shoulders of emperors and high priests.
It explains why this stuff was so expensive that it became associated with royalty and divinity across the entire Mediterranean basin. The Roman Emperor Aurelian in the 3rd century CE actually forbade anyone but the emperor from wearing Tyrian purple on pain of death. Not a fine, death. That's how seriously they took this color.
Here's a detail that puts the economics in perspective. The Roman historian Pliny the Elder wrote that Tyrian purple dye was worth its weight in silver, not the dyed fabric, the raw dye powder. You could literally trade it gram for gram with precious metal, a pound of dye for a pound of silver.
It's the original sumptuary law. You can legislate who gets to wear what based entirely on the fact that there aren't enough snails. And the law isn't just about keeping the paws in their place. It's actually reflecting a genuine material scarcity. There literally weren't enough snails to dye everyone's clothes purple.
For the ancient Israelites, tashaleh had a specific religious significance that went beyond the economic rarity. The commandment comes from Numbers chapter 15, verse 38. God instructs Moses to tell the Israelites to put tzitzit, fringes, on the corners of their garments and to include a thread of tashaleh on each fringe. The color was also used extensively in the tabernacle and in the high priest's garments. The Talmud discusses it in detail. The dye had to come from a specific sea creature called the chilazon, which the rabbis described as a creature that emerges from the sea once every 70 years, whose blood was used for the dye.
Once every 70 years? That sounds like either a mythological embellishment or a description of something so rare that people believed it only appeared once in a lifetime. But what's interesting to me is that the rabbis are describing a biological organism with a specific harvesting pattern. They're not saying it's a mineral or a plant. They know it's a sea creature. That's a concrete detail embedded in a religious legal text.
It was probably a reflection of how difficult the harvesting was. These snails aren't exactly lining up on the beach. They live in rocky intertidal zones, and collecting thousands of them by hand is backbreaking work. You have to pry them off rocks while waves are crashing into you. The 70-year thing was likely rabbinic hyperbole to emphasize the rarity, but it also might reflect the fact that snail populations can crash after intensive harvesting and take decades to recover. So the snails might literally have disappeared from a given stretch of coast for a human lifetime.
The dye was in continuous use throughout the biblical period and into the early centuries of the Common Era. What actually caused it to disappear?
The standard narrative points to the Islamic conquest of the Levant in the 7th century CE, which disrupted the trade networks and the coastal dyeing operations. But it's more complicated than that. By that point, the Roman Empire had already been restricting Tyrian purple production for centuries, and the snail populations along the Levantine coast had been severely overharvested. The combination of ecological depletion and political disruption meant that the specific knowledge of how to identify the chilazon, harvest it, and process it for chile as opposed to Tyrian purple was gradually lost. By the time Jewish communities were reestablished in the region, nobody knew which creature the chilazon actually was.
This is a classic case of tacit knowledge loss. It's not that someone burned the last instruction manual. It's that the knowledge lived in the hands and eyes of the dyers. And when the trade networks collapsed and the workshops closed, there was no one left to teach the next generation. You can't learn how to identify the right snail from a book, especially when you don't even know which book to look in.
And the Talmudic descriptions are detailed, but not operational. They tell you the Chilazon has a shell, that it lives in the sea, that its body resembles the sea, but they don't give you a Linnaean taxonomy. The rabbis weren't writing a field guide. They were writing legal rulings for people who already knew what the creature was.
That's where the detective story begins. Because for over 1,000 years, rabbis, scholars, and eventually scientists tried to figure out what this thing was.
The most famous wrong answer came from Rabbi Gershon Henoch Lehner, known as the Radziner Rebbe. In the 1880s, he became convinced that the Chilazon was the cuttlefish, specifically Sepia officinalis, the common cuttlefish. He traveled to the aquarium in Naples to study marine life. He consulted with chemists, and in 1887 he published a book called Sifune Temune Chol, laying out his case. He even began producing a blue dye from cuttlefish ink and distributing it to his followers.
He was wrong.
Cuttlefish ink produces a dark sepia brown, not blue. To get a blue color, he had to add iron filings and other chemical treatments. The resulting dye was essentially synthetic. It had nothing to do with the biological molecule that produces tachalet. But his followers wore it for decades, and some still do.
That's a painful kind of error. He did the legwork, he traveled, he published, but the chemistry just wasn't there yet. And I think it's worth sitting with that for a second, because it's easy to look back and laugh at the guy who thought cuttlefish made blue dye. But he was operating in the 1880s. The periodic table had only been finalized about 20 years earlier. Organic chemistry was in its infancy. He had no way to do the kind of molecular analysis that would have shown him his error.
To his credit, he was trying to apply the best available science. He consulted with chemists. He went to an aquarium. He wasn't just sitting in his study guessing, he was doing field work. The problem was that the tools to actually answer the question didn't exist yet.
How do we get from the Radziner Rebbe's cuttlefish mistake to the actual solution?
The real breakthrough came from Rabbi Yitzhak Halevi Herzog, who would later become the first chief rabbi of Israel. In 1913, as a young rabbinical student, he wrote his doctoral dissertation on tachalet. He systematically analyzed every candidate that had been proposed, cuttlefish, various mollusks, even a type of jellyfish, and he concluded that the most likely candidate was a snail from the Murex family. He noted that Murex trunculus produced a dye that matched the Talmudic descriptions, and that archaeological evidence from ancient dye factories along the coast of Phoenicia showed massive piles of Murex shells, but he couldn't prove it chemically. The analytical techniques just didn't exist yet.
Herzog had the right snail in 1913, but he couldn't confirm it. What actually closed the case?
The chemical confirmation came from a surprising direction. In the 1980s, a chemist named Otto Elsner was working at the Shenkar College of Engineering and Design in Israel. He wasn't studying tachalet at all. He was interested in the chemistry of ancient dyes. He noticed that when Murex trunculus dye was exposed to ultraviolet light during the dyeing process, it turned blue instead of purple. He published his findings, and they caught the attention of Rabbi Eliyahu Tavger, who had been independently researching the tachalet question.
A textile chemist stumbles onto the answer while working on a completely different problem. That's how so many of these discoveries actually happen. It's never the person who sets out to find the thing. It's the person in the next lab over who says, huh, that's weird.
Tabger and a team of researchers, including Dr. Baruch Sturman and Dr. Ari Greenspan, spent years refining the process. They worked with marine biologists to identify the specific Murex populations along the Israeli coast that produced the right shade of blue. They experimented with different dyeing techniques to match the Talmudic descriptions. And in the 1990s, they founded the Pitil Tekelet organization to produce authentic tachalet from Murex snails and make it available to anyone who wanted to fulfill the commandment.
That brings us to the archaeological confirmation, which has really accelerated in the last few years. This isn't just a story about chemistry and snails anymore. The dirt archaeologists have weighed in.
This is where the story gets even more grounded. In 2023 and 2024, excavations at Tel Shikmona, just south of Haifa, uncovered large-scale dye production facilities dating to the 6th century BCE. We're talking about vats, processing tools, and massive piles of Murex shells, some of them still showing traces of the dye. Chemical analysis of residues in the vats confirmed the presence of DBI, the same molecule that P. tiltecolite extracts from modern snails.
6th century BCE. That's the first temple period. This industry was operating right when the biblical texts were being written and compiled. So the commandment in Numbers isn't describing some hypothetical ideal. It's describing an active industrial practice that was happening within walking distance of Jerusalem.
Then in 2024, a team led by Dr. Nama Sukenik of the Israel Antiquities Authority published a study in the journal PLOS-1 that used high-performance liquid chromatography with mass spectrometry, HPLC-MS, to analyze textile fragments from the Cave of Letters in the Judean Desert. These fragments date to the Bar Kokhba Revolt around 135 CE, and they found DBI residues on wool fibers that had been dyed blue. This was the first direct chemical evidence that tachelet was actually being used on textiles in the land of Israel during the Roman period.
The chain of evidence is complete. Biblical text, Talmudic description, archaeological production sites, chemical residue on ancient fabric, and a living snail population that produces the exact same molecule. That's about as definitive as ancient history ever gets. You rarely get all five links in the chain.
It's worth pausing on the analytical technique because it's the same approach that's being used to decode other ancient pigments. HPLC. MS separates the chemical components of a sample and then identifies each one by its molecular weight. DBI has a distinctive mass spectrum because of those bromine atoms. Bromine has two stable isotopes, bromine 79 and bromine 81, which create a characteristic double peak in the mass spectrum. It's like a chemical fingerprint that's impossible to mistake for anything else.
The bromine atoms that make the dye photochemically active are also what make it identifiable in a lab 2,000 years later. That's elegant. The same feature that made the dye work in the ancient world is the feature that lets us prove it's the real thing today.
It really is, and it connects to why this dye was so hard to replace in the ancient world. There were other blue dyes available, woad in Europe, indigo in Asia and Africa, but none of them had that photochemical behavior. The Talmud actually specifies that tachelet must be colorfast and that its color must be indistinguishable from the sky. Plant indigo fades over time. DBI from murex snails bonds to wool so tightly that it essentially becomes part of the fiber. There are textile fragments from 2,000 years ago that still show the blue color.
That's a practical consideration that often gets lost in the symbolism. The dye wasn't just symbolically distinctive, it was physically superior for the application. If you're making a ritual garment that's supposed to last, you want the dye that doesn't fade after 3 washings.
The symbolism was layered on top of that practical superiority. The Talmud connects tachelet to the sea, the sky, and the throne of God. It's a chain of association that moves from the physical to the metaphysical. The snail comes from the sea. The color resembles the sea reflects the sky, and the sky is where the divine presence is understood to reside. The thread on the tzitzit was meant to remind the wearer of all of these connections.
It's a mnemonic device encoded in color. You look at the thread, you think of the sea, then the sky, then God. That's a remarkably sophisticated piece of cognitive design for a religious garment. It's almost like a medieval memory palace compressed into a single visual cue.
It only works if the blue is exactly right. If the color is off, if it's too purple, too green, too pale, the whole chain of associations breaks. That's why the Talmud is so specific about the color being indistinguishable from the sky, and why the rabbis were so concerned with the authenticity of the dye source. A bad blue doesn't just look wrong. It fails to do its cognitive and spiritual job.
That raises a question I hadn't thought about before. What does indistinguishable from the sky actually mean in practice? The sky isn't one color. It changes from pale blue at noon to deep indigo at twilight. Which sky are we matching?
That's actually been a point of debate among the dyers. The consensus that emerged from P. tiltecolite's work is that the target is the sky at midday, a clear deep blue that's not so dark it approaches purple and not so pale it approaches white. But you're right that the Talmudic standard is inherently subjective. It relies on a human observer making a judgment call, which means there's always going to be a range of acceptable shades rather than a single Pantone number.
Which feels appropriate, honestly. A religious commandment that's about perception and association probably shouldn't be reducible to a hex code.
Let's talk about the modern revival, because this isn't just a historical curiosity anymore. People are actually wearing this today. As of 2026, the Petil Tekelet organization produces tekele from farmed and wild-harvested murex snails along the Israeli coast. They sell dyed wool threads that can be tied onto the tzitzit of a prayer shawl. A single set of tashale threads costs somewhere between $50 and $100, depending on the quality and the specific tying method. They estimate that about 30,000 talitot with authentic tashale are sold annually worldwide.
30,000 talitot a year. That's not a mass market product, but it's also not a tiny niche. There's real demand for this. And if you do the math, 30,000 sets at, say, $75 on average, that's over $2 million a year in revenue. This is a real industry again, for the first time in 1,300 years.
It's growing. The process remains labor-intensive and expensive because each snail still only produces those 1 to 2 milligrams of dye. Till Tekelet has experimented with snail farming to reduce pressure on wild populations, but murex snails grow slowly and require specific habitat conditions. It's not like farming tilapia. You can't just throw them in a pond and come back in 6 months. These are predatory snails that need live prey, specific water temperatures, and rocky substrate. They're fussy.
The same ecological constraints that made the dye rare in the ancient world are still operating today. We've got better technology, but the snails haven't gotten any faster. They're still producing 1 milligram of dye at their own pace, and no amount of venture capital is going to change mollusk metabolism.
There's a new concern that didn't exist in the Iron Age. Climate change is affecting Mediterranean marine ecosystems, and the murex populations are shifting. Warming waters, changes in salinity, ocean acidification, all of these stressors affect mollusk populations. The long-term viability of natural tashale production isn't guaranteed.
Which raises the question, can we make this molecule without the snails?
This is where synthetic biology enters the picture. In 2025, a paper in Nature Chemical Biology demonstrated engineered E. coli bacteria that could produce DBI precursors. The researchers inserted genes from marine bacteria that naturally produce brominated compounds into E. coli, and the modified bacteria started churning out the chemical building blocks of DBI. But, and this is the crucial caveat, they haven't yet replicated the full photochemical process. The engineered bacteria produce the molecule, but getting it to behave exactly like snail-extracted DBI during dyeing is a different challenge.
We're at the point where we can make the molecule in a vat of bacteria, but we can't yet make it work the way the snail version works. That feels like a metaphor for something. We can copy the blueprint, but we can't replicate the factory conditions that make the blueprint actually function.
The history of synthetic dyes is full of these partial successes. The first synthetic indigo was developed in 1880 by Adolf von Baeyer, and it eventually replaced natural indigo almost entirely, but it took decades to get the industrial process right. The first synthetic Tyrian purple was made in 1903 by Paul Friedlander, who bought 12,000 murex snails from a French supplier, extracted the dye, figured out the chemical structure, and then synthesized it. He published the synthesis and then basically said, well, that was interesting, moving on.
12,000 snails. The same number it takes to dye one talit. That's a grim coincidence. Or maybe not a coincidence at all. He might have calculated exactly how many he needed to get enough material for a proper analysis.
Or a deliberate choice. He may have wanted to demonstrate that he understood the scale of the ancient industry. But his synthetic Tyrian purple never caught on commercially because the industrial processes of the time couldn't produce it cheaply enough to compete with other synthetic dyes. The molecule was known, the synthesis was published, but the economics didn't work.
Even when you know the chemistry, the manufacturing is its own problem. The snail is still the most efficient factory for this particular molecule. Which is humbling. A sea snail is outperforming the entire organic chemistry industry.
But the synthetic biology approach is different from Friedlander's organic synthesis. Engineered bacteria can potentially produce complex molecules at scale in fermentation tanks, the same way we produce insulin and other biologics. If someone cracks the full DBI pathway, including the photochemical behavior, we could see a future where authentic tashale is available for a fraction of the current cost, without harvesting a single snail.
That would create an interesting halakhic question. If the dye is chemically identical but produced by bacteria in a factory, does it count? Is the commandment about the snail or about the molecule?
Rabbis are already debating this, and opinions differ. Some argue that the Talmudic requirement is specifically for the chilazon, the sea creature, and that synthetic DBI, even if chemically identical, wouldn't fulfill the commandment. Others argue that the commandment is about the color and the molecule, and that the source is incidental. It's the same kind of debate that played out over synthetic indigo for ritual uses in other traditions.
That's an unresolved tension, and it mirrors debates in other areas. When does a traditionally sourced material lose its identity when you make it in a lab? Vanilla, saffron, musk. Same conversation, different molecule. The vanilla case is actually a perfect parallel. Most vanilla flavoring today is synthetic vanillin, but if you're a purist, only the stuff from the orchid counts, even though the molecule is identical.
It's worth stepping back to consider what the Tachelet story actually represents. This is a case study in how ancient technology can be reconstructed through interdisciplinary science. You need biblical scholarship to understand what the texts are describing. You need Talmudic analysis to extract the technical details from rabbinic discussions. You need marine biology to identify the candidate species. You need archaeology to confirm that the species was actually used in the right time and place. You need chemistry to prove that the molecule matches the ancient residues, and you need textile engineering to reconstruct the dyeing process.
No single discipline could have solved this. It took all of them working together over more than a century. And that's a useful corrective to the way we usually tell stories about discovery, the lone genius in the lab having a eureka moment. This was a relay race, not a sprint.
The same approach is being applied to other lost ancient technologies. Egyptian blue, the first synthetic pigment ever created, calcium copper silicate, was lost for centuries and then reconstructed through chemical analysis of residues on ancient artifacts. Maya blue, a remarkably durable pigment made from indigo and a clay called palygorskite, resisted chemical analysis for decades until researchers figured out that the indigo molecules were trapped inside the clay's crystal structure. The techniques that confirmed Chele, HPLC, MS, radiocarbon dating, spectroscopic analysis, are the same tools being used across the field of archaeological chemistry.
The listener who's interested in this story isn't just learning about a blue dye. They're learning about how we recover lost knowledge in general. The Tachelet case is unusually well documented and unusually complete, which makes it a good model for understanding how these rediscoveries work. If you can follow the Tachelet story, you basically understand the playbook for reconstructing any lost ancient technology.
There's a practical dimension that I think is worth emphasizing. The next time you see a blue thread on a prayer shawl, or even just a photo of one, you're looking at a molecule that was lost for 1,300 years. The chemical structure of that blue is C16H8Br2N2O2. Those two bromine atoms are what make it Tachelet and not indigo. And the fact that we know that we can point to the exact atoms and say, this is the difference, is a testament to what happens when you combine ancient texts with modern science.
It's also a reminder that some knowledge isn't ever truly lost. It's just inaccessible until the right tools come along. The snails were always there. The dye was always producible. The texts were always available. What was missing was the analytical framework to connect them. And the interesting question is, what other knowledge is sitting in that same state right now, waiting for the right tool to come along?
The willingness to spend decades on a question that most people considered unanswerable. Rabbi Herzog wrote his dissertation in 1913. Otto Elsner made his discovery in the 1980s. Till Tekalit started producing dye in the 1990s. The Sukenik paper confirming DBI on ancient textiles came out in 2024. This is a century-long chain of individual researchers, each adding one link.
The Ratzinger Rebbe was wrong, but he was wrong in a way that pushed the conversation forward. His cuttlefish theory forced people to engage with the question seriously, and the refutation of his theory clarified what the correct answer had to look like. Even the mistakes contributed to the eventual solution.
That's a generous reading, but I think it's accurate. Science advances by falsification as much as by confirmation. Knowing what the chilazon isn't narrows the field of what it could be. Herzog was able to build on the failure of the cuttlefish hypothesis because it had already been tested and eliminated. That's not wasted effort, that's the necessary groundwork.
Where does this leave us going forward? The synthetic biology work is promising but incomplete. The snail populations are under environmental pressure. The demand for Tachelet is growing. What's the most likely path?
In the short term, probably a combination of wild harvesting and small-scale aquaculture. Teal Tekeled has been working on sustainable harvesting practices, and there are efforts to establish Murex farms that can produce dye without depleting wild populations. In the medium term, if the synthetic biology approach succeeds, we might see a transition to fermentation-produced DBI that's chemically identical to the snail version. And in the long term, the halakhic debate about synthetic versus natural will probably produce a range of opinions, and different communities will follow different rulings.
Which is basically how Jewish law has always worked. Multiple valid opinions, different communities making different choices, and the underlying commandment remaining constant. The debate isn't a bug. It's the feature that keeps the tradition alive and adapting.
The threat of Tachelet on the Tzitzit is meant to remind the wearer of the sea, the sky, and the divine. Whether that thread comes from a snail harvested off the coast of Haifa or from a fermentation tank in a biotech facility, the molecule is the same, the color is the same, and the reminder is the same.
That's a good place to land. The dye was lost, it was found, and now the question is how to keep it accessible without destroying the source. That's a very modern problem for a very ancient color. And it's the kind of problem that the people who first harvested those snails 3,000 years ago never could have imagined, but they'd probably recognize the impulse behind it. The desire to make something beautiful and meaningful, and to keep making it, generation after generation.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the high medieval period, natural philosophers on the island of Réunion believed that epiphytic orchids growing on volcanic rock faces were not plants at all, but crystallized bird breath, a theory based on the observation that orchids seemed to appear spontaneously on bare rock where birds had been heard singing. This was the dominant botanical framework on the island until French colonial botanists debunked it in the 1760s.
Crystallized bird breath. I have so many follow-up questions and I'm afraid to ask any of them.
We're going to need a moment with that one. The idea that someone looked at an orchid and thought, yes, a bird exhaled and it solidified. That's a level of creative taxonomy that I almost admire.
It's not that different from the Radzina River and his cuttlefish, honestly. You observe something you can't explain. You construct a theory based on the best available information, and you commit to it. Sometimes you get Tachelet from snails. Sometimes you get crystallized bird breath. This has been My Weird Prompts, thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping the show running and for facts that will haunt me for the rest of the week. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps more people find the show. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.